Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
What we have seen is that there simply is no safe place in Gaza, not for civilians, not for humanitarian aid workers.
Ships full of food aid are turning back from Gaza after Israel killed 7 international charity workers with World Central Kitchen. It's Tuesday, April 2nd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Israel has killed nearly 200 aid workers in Gaza since October 7th. 3 times the death toll recorded in any single conflict in a year, according to Jamie McGoldrick of the United Nations. Today on the show, we'll hear from one humanitarian group about Israel's latest attack on people delivering food to starving Palestinians, and how that work can go on as the violence escalates. Also, the last 2 survivors of the Tulsa race massacre, both 109 years old, are seeking reparations for victims of the 1921 assault on the neighborhood once known as Black Wall Street.
I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot.
But we'll start today in Florida, where the state Supreme Court yesterday cleared the way for 2 big ballot measures that are sure to affect turnout in November. And more importantly, will impact civil rights for tens of millions of Floridians. Voters will get their say on abortion rights and recreational marijuana use in November. But at least until then, Florida's abortion ban could get even more strict than it is now. Douglas Soule stopped by to explain. He's been covering this for the USA Today Florida Network. Here's what he told Deepa Fernandez.
On the ballot will be a constitutional amendment that would legalize recreational marijuana here in the Sunshine State and another guaranteeing abortion access. Now, for these to become the law of the land here in Florida, they would need to be approved by at least 60% of the vote.
That's a high margin.
It is, and it's higher than a lot of other states. But it'll be a battle on both sides for and against both of these amendments. And Floridians should expect to see ample advertisements and political mentions of these issues in the next half year leading up to the general election.
You know, I just want to state too, right here before we talk a little bit more about that, that at the same time the judges ruled in favor of putting abortion access on the ballot, they also cleared the way for a pending 6-week abortion ban to go into effect in 30 days. So where does abortion stand now, and how will that change next month for Floridians?
Yeah, so the state Supreme Court, alongside these other rulings related to the amendments, upheld a 15-week abortion ban the state passed in 2022, saying that privacy protections in the state constitution didn't apply to abortion. That, you know, overruled decades of precedent here in Florida. And so last year, the state also, as you mentioned, passed a 6-week abortion ban, which, you know, 6 weeks is before many people would know they're pregnant. That would take effect in a month with some exceptions, such as fetal abnormalities or to save a woman's life and rape and incest.
So basically, the 15-week ban being declared constitutional is triggering the 6-week ban going into effect in a month. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so it's now going to be banned, but there is a chance via this amendment on the November ballot that it could actually be enshrined into the Constitution. I'm wondering what the reaction has been from Governor Ron DeSantis, who didn't want to leave these measures up to the Florida voters.
Governor Ron DeSantis, he has said in a statement that his office sent out yesterday, well, first and foremost, his office pointed out that the three justices that dissented on the abortion amendment ruling were all women. His office also accused that amendment of being misleading and confusing and claims the amendment would mandate abortions up to the time of birth. Now, abortion advocates do not agree with the governor's take, saying that, for example, the term viability, which is in the amendment, is well known, with 24 weeks being the generally cited time frame. But that comment, mixed with all the other comments we've seen from conservatives who aren't happy about this amendment, show that there is a fight up ahead. And I imagine a lot of money will be poured into the campaign for and against this amendment here in Florida, especially following the abortion ban being upheld. I mean, you've got to figure that this is going to be discussed in excess here in Florida, as well as across the nation. So it's going to be a busy half year, we can tell that, and a lot's at stake for both sides.
And what is the track record of Florida voters when it comes to approving state constitutional amendments, given that the threshold is so high at 60%?
Yeah, so the threshold is high, but there have been a series of more progressive amendments that have passed in Florida in recent years. And these are amendments that the conservative legislature wasn't all too happy with and wouldn't have passed on its own. For example, you know, in recent years, voters have approved voting rights for Floridians previously convicted of felonies. They've raised the minimum wage. They've legalized medical marijuana. So, yes, in Florida, even though the state legislature has a Republican supermajority, these more progressive amendments have in the past passed. Now, the big question is, if they were to pass, what could and would the legislature do about that? GOP lawmakers have in the past tried to dull the sharpness of constitutional amendments. For example, with the felony voting rights one, they added a requirement that to restore your voting rights, you first have to pay off your fines and fees. They initially required banned smokable forms of medical marijuana, though that was later changed. So, you know, the battle for and against will continue even after the vote if it were to pass. But you've got to imagine both sides are hoping that it goes their way, and we'll have to see with the threshold being 60%. It'll be a well-advertised topic, and it'll be one that Floridians are seeing and talking about for many months.
Douglas Soule is the First Amendment reporter for the USA Today Florida Network. Douglas, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, the latest developments in the Middle East. When we return, we'll hear how NGOs are responding to Israel's killing of 7 aid workers in Gaza. And we'll also consider that airstrike on Iran's consulate in Syria, a major escalation in the regional conflict. Iran says Israel is to blame. Scott Tong has more after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Get your quote at progressive.com and see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
What happens next for food aid into Gaza? Today, World Central Kitchen paused its work there after Israeli airstrikes killed 6 of their international aid workers and their Palestinian driver. The group calls it a targeted attack. The Israeli military confirmed the deadly strike, and Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israeli forces unintentionally hit innocent people and said, "We will do everything to make sure this does not happen again." For more on aid groups and their work in Gaza, we have Shayna Lowe on the line. She's spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council Palestine. Shayna, welcome.
Thank you.
World Central Kitchen says the Israeli drone strike hit the group's vehicles that were emblazoned with the big logos of the charity on the vehicles. The group says its workers were targeted. Do you find that a possibility, that the international aid workers were in fact targeted?
Absolutely. Not only is it a possibility, and we've seen multiple times over the last few months, aid convoys be targeted, warehouses housing aid for humanitarian agencies be targeted. But even the Israeli media today has been reporting that it was an intentional target on this convoy and that there was a suspected alleged terrorist, as the Israeli media referred to it, that they were going after. And there were, my understanding is, three drone strikes that hit this convoy, one car after another, as people got out of the cars and tried to flee for safety.
And as you see it, this is not the first potentially targeted strike there. Yeah.
I mean, what we have seen is that there simply is no safe place in Gaza, not for civilians, not for humanitarian aid workers who are seeking to provide life-saving assistance to the desperate civilians in need throughout all of Gaza. We've seen over 170 humanitarian aid workers killed since the start of this escalation nearly six months ago. And so this is not the first time that we've seen humanitarians be killed. And I'm very worried that, of course, this won't be the last time that we see humanitarians killed in Israeli strikes.
Yeah. Now, for the record, the Israeli military says it will do a thorough investigation of what happened. I want to ask about how humanitarian groups in Gaza work to coordinate with military actors to keep their workers safe. In this case, World Central Kitchen says it did coordinate with the Israeli military. How is this coordination in the field supposed to work?
Well, either humanitarian agencies directly or through the UN notify the Israeli military through their special COGAT unit, which coordinates humanitarian affairs in the occupied territory. They notify them of the coordinates of both locations that are housing humanitarians or where humanitarian aid is being stored, and also of their movements. And most of the time they wait, and they certainly wait until they get verification that message has been received, with the assurances, or at least the assumption, that humanitarians and humanitarian convoys will be protected and not be targeted.
And in your view, how well does this notification system work or not work?
Well, we've seen over the last 6 months, dozens, over 150 humanitarians be killed during this conflict. And we know that oftentimes the UN has reported that they're either denied access or don't even get responses and are forced to abort missions. We've seen humanitarian convoys, UN convoys, be hit with tank shells or shells fired from the Israeli Navy. And so while we, of course, hope that it works and are doing our best to ensure that our employees are safe, there's no guarantees, particularly when we see seven employees of an international humanitarian agency targeted, as we did yesterday.
Yeah. Shana, at least one other major aid group says it's halted its operation in Gaza, the group ANERA. I hope I'm saying that right. But I understand your organization for now plans to stay?
Yes, for now we are continuing with the work that we are doing. We have a staff of around 40 local employees on the ground in Gaza, as well as more than half a dozen internationals helping to coordinate our response. And we will do the best that we can to keep our staff safe while also delivering life-saving assistance that the 2.3 million Palestinians trapped in Gaza for the last 6 months so desperately need.
Yeah, but I think we just heard you say there may be nowhere safe.
Well, there is nowhere safe, certainly not. But we will do the best to ensure that our employees are in the safer areas, and that we make sure that, to the best of our ability, that when our staff are traveling or going to conduct distributions, that there are notifications made to the parties involved, including the Israeli military. And of course, we have to hope for the best, that they won't be targeted as we saw yesterday.
All right. Have you spoken to your colleagues in Gaza? What are you hearing from them?
I did speak to one of my colleagues yesterday after we heard the news. He actually knew one of the aid workers who was killed yesterday, the driver of one of the World Central Kitchen cars. I mean, this is something that on the one hand was quite shocking and on the other hand has turned into just another part of daily life, hearing about friends and acquaintances and colleagues being killed and knowing that there really are no assurances that they or anyone else in Gaza will live to see the next day.
Shana Lowe is spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Shana, we send our best to you and your team, and thanks.
Thank you.
An airstrike in Syria yesterday killed 7 Iranians at their consulate in Syria. That is a major breach of international norms. Attacking a country's diplomatic residence is viewed as attacking the country itself. Now, Iran blames Israel for the strike, and one of Iran's top military advisors is among the dead. Could this widen the conflict in the Middle East? Let's put that now to hear now security analyst Jim Walsh of the MIT Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Scott. Always good to be with you.
Israel has not yet claimed responsibility for the attack, but I understand many experts think indeed that was the case. Is that your assumption, your understanding as well?
It is. It's that, and there are several reasons for that, not the least of which, Scott, is that over the past several months and even years, we've had sort of a shadow war unfolding in Syria with attacks back and forth, but in recent months, primarily Israel attacking targets in Lebanon, but in Syria and including Iranians in Syria.
Yeah. Jim, is this a significant escalation of these long-term tensions?
I think it is. I mean, it's sort of unprecedented to go and bomb a country's diplomatic facility, which, as you suggest, is considered part of the country's territory, actually. But, you know, how provocative it will be will depend on how Iran responds. And, you know, Israel may have different motivations for wanting to carry out this attack. But one of the larger questions is, how do they expect Iran to answer this? Do they expect them to sort of swallow it and vow revenge in the future and not do very much, which is what I think myself and most analysts expect. They don't expect Iran to escalate. And so is Israel doing this because, you know, they can in some sense maybe get away with it because things are so fragile right now? Or is it that they actually want to expand the war? And I think that's less likely, but I think it's a proposition we should at least consider.
Yeah. I want to ask about that. But first of all, as far as the Iranian response, Tehran has vowed vengeance for this airstrike. Why wouldn't it counter and do something?
Oh, I think it will, or it certainly will aspire to. But, you know, imagine a situation in which a senior official is killed, you know, or an attack on 9/11 or something, and the state responds, you know, that's it, we're declaring war, you know, we're mobilizing our forces, even if we're not declaring war, we're putting our forces on alert. You know, there are different things you could do that would signal a much stronger, what in our world we call a kinetic response, something that kills people. But if you're just saying, we'll get you later, you know, and sort of vaguely vowing something in the future, then that doesn't seem as ominous.
Yeah, because potentially the moment from Iran's perspective, this might not be the right moment.
Yeah, well, I think Iran, there are several reasons why people, including me, think Iran would be reluctant to enter a war. I know Iran's reputation is it wants to destroy Israel and it's got tentacles everywhere and all the rest of it. But the fact is that most analysts see Iran as acting as restrained right now, a restrained calculator. The reason being they have economic problems at home. They have domestic problems at home. They're not in a position of strength, and they probably don't want to fight a big war against Israel. And so, again, does Israel want to take advantage of that, or are they looking to goad them into it? But Iran has to be careful about how the leadership has to respond. I mean, we just had, you know, recent elections in Iran that were not well attended, and then the supreme leader recently criticized the president of Iran for his economic policies. There have been other sorts of turmoil, so I think they're hesitant.
Jim, as far as Israel, and you noted what their motivation might be, we should note the victims in the strike include 2 Iranian generals. One is from an elite division. How do you think about what Israel's motivations, what the range of motivations might be here?
Yeah, well, part of it might be operational. You know, we're going to go take out one of their senior guys and that, and you, with their hope that maybe that would disrupt their operations, or maybe because they're thinking they plan to expand operations in Syria and disrupting them would be a good first move. It might be that there are political motivations. Netanyahu might be looking, as a matter of personal politics, to try to reestablish his credentials in the national security arena after the disaster of the October 7th raid. Israel, more generally as a government, I think would prefer that people focus on Israel versus Iran versus Israel versus Gaza, to reframe the international conversation. Now, I don't think that fared very well if that was the motivation, because on the same day as the strike, you had newspapers leading with the fact that Israel had massacred those aid workers. So, that one didn't work out. Maybe they're trying to put pressure on a third party that we can't even figure out. But those are some of the motivations that Israel could have. Maybe just thinking we can get away with some things in the chaos of war that you normally wouldn't be able to get away with.
Yeah. And Jim, a little more than a minute here. We have discussed with you before Iran's so-called axis of resistance. Iran funds groups throughout the Middle East, including Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, groups that have attacked Israel and its allies. What should we watch for, not just from Iran as a response, but its proxies?
Yeah, the most important by far, bar none, is Hezbollah, right there on the border with rockets and missiles. And the question is whether they do anything. They're the player closest to the action. They all have their own interests and their own calculations, but they do have a close relationship with Iran. But, Iran doesn't have the Air Force to carry out a direct attack, and it's far away. So if something happens in the future that's escalation, it will probably involve Hezbollah and Lebanon.
We've been talking to Here and Now, a security analyst, Jim Walsh. Jim, thank you as always.
Thanks, Scott.
Coming up, two 109-year-old women are in court seeking reparations more than a century after a racist mob terrorized their neighborhood and burned down Tulsa's Black Wall Street. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them, and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There's some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
In 1921, a mob of white people rampaged through a black neighborhood, burning the business district known as Black Wall Street to the ground and killing as many as 300 people. But you probably didn't learn about the Tulsa Race Massacre in school. For almost a century, it was a blemish on American history that many wanted to forget or ignore. And as that history finally begins to get its due, The last two survivors of the Tulsa race massacre are telling their stories before the Oklahoma Supreme Court today. Lessie Benningfield Randall and Viola Ford Fletcher are both 109 years old. Fletcher told Congress a few years ago she'll never forget the violence of the white mob.
I still see black men seeing being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot.
She's now fighting for reparations for the victims' families. Dion Osborne is a journalist writing for the Oklahoma Eagle. He spoke to Deepa Fernandez.
Dion, let's start with the history for those who might not be aware of the events. Can you remind us what happened on May 31 back in 1921?
Yes, it was over a period of hours, much like what was taking place across the country during that time. You had white mobs forming to attack and destroy black communities. In this case, you had a case of a young black boy being accused of sexually assaulting a white girl. You had a white mob form. The young black boy, Dick Rowland, was captured by the local sheriff. He was housed at the sheriff's station. The white mob tried to capture him. And in this case, you had black men from the community of Greenwood who had just returned from the World War, who were trained and armed. And so they tried to defend their community. Unfortunately, the city deputized thousands, and ultimately Greenwood was overrun and it was a massacre.
Now, people lost family members, homes, businesses. It's a straight line to generational wealth. Can you describe the long-term impact on the community?
Well, there's a street in Tulsa, Peoria Avenue, and if you drive from the very south to the very north, once you cross the train tracks entering into the Greenwood District, the historically black community, you can see the impact. It's visual. The lack of economic development, the 10-year life expectancy gap between people in North Tulsa and South Tulsa, the lack of health services, the lack of education opportunities, the over-policing in these black communities. And so as the attorneys for the survivors are arguing, they say the impact from the massacre can still be felt today.
So let's talk about what's going to happen. We have two of the survivors who are now 109. They're traveling to court. A third survivor who was part of this case has since died. How significant, Dion, is it that they're in court there? And do you know, are they speaking, what they have to say?
Yes, this is hugely significant. This is, by all accounts, their potentially last opportunity to seek justice in Oklahoma courts. The survivors are giving oral arguments for the very first time since the massacre. The reason that it's at the Oklahoma Supreme Court right now is because the case had actually been dismissed last year at the Tulsa County level. The attorneys for survivors appealed immediately after the dismissal, and the Oklahoma Supreme Court actually decided to take up their case.
And this is just to see whether they actually can have a full trial. This is not to decide whether they get reparations. Is that right?
Right. We don't know the timeline for when they will decide. All they're deciding is whether the dismissal of this case should be reversed. If they decide to reverse that dismissal, it'll go back to Tulsa County for a trial. If the high court upholds the dismissal, it cannot be tried again.
That's the end of the road. We're speaking with Dion Osborne, a journalist writing for the Oklahoma Eagle. So, Dion, what are they arguing in court today? Because the lawsuit is filed under the state's public nuisance law, and the survivors claim the impact of the massacre is still being felt today. Can you flesh out more of what they'll tell the court?
Right. We pretty much have an idea of what both sides are arguing today based on previous court filings. The survivors and their attorneys will be arguing that not only were they harmed due to this, what they call public nuisance, as a result of the city-sanctioned massacre, but they're also arguing that the city, the county, the state has been unjustly enriched by the tourism attractions from telling their story. And so they're arguing for survivors and descendants to be able to be given a trial to seek reparations, restitution for the massacre. Now, on the defendant's side, the attorneys for the city, county, and state are arguing not only has too much time passed, but they're also arguing, and they've said this in court filings, that just because survivors lived through the massacre does not automatically mean that they deserve reparations or restitution for it.
I want to ask you about, you know, some of the calls for justice implicate the city and the state, or say that they were complicit in the massacre. One example, the state claims the National Guard was activated only to quell the disturbances and left Tulsa after the mission was accomplished. But the survivors allege the National Guard members participated in the massacre, in fact, systematically rounding up African Americans and going even as far as to kill those who would not leave their homes. Is complicity of Oklahoma officials at play here?
If you look to the records from the Tulsa Historical Society, there's a paragraph that explains how the National Guard rounded up thousands of Black residents, interning them against their will for days. You have historical accounts, narratives from survivors who've now passed, saying that some of these Oklahoma National Guard members did, in fact, shoot and attack Black residents who were trying to defend themselves. And so that's kind of what is at play, is the culpability and how much the evidence supports that.
And in the past, was there ever anyone held accountable for this?
There has never been a single person held accountable for this. Some people may be wondering, you know, it's 2024, this happened 103 years ago, why is it just now reaching the Oklahoma Supreme Court? That's due by design. So following the massacre, hundreds of Black folks did try, in fact, to recoup their damages. But the city referred to the incident as a riot. For much of the last century, it's been referred to as a riot. And because it was given that designation, you know, loan agencies and insurance companies did not have to pay out anything because of a clause in their contracts that said they will not pay for anything that is damaged due to a riot. And so the first attempts at justice in 1921 failed. You had literal Klan members on the rosters in the courtrooms as judges, as attorneys. And so their attempts were just thrown out immediately after the massacre. In the early 2000s, you did have a group of survivors reach the U.S. Supreme Court, but that was thrown out due to a statute of limitations. And so this really is the last opportunity. They used a creative avenue to get this into the Oklahoma courts using state law instead of federal law, which sidesteps the statute of limitations.
And just finally, Dion, what do you think the victims' families are hoping for? I mean, we've heard such loud proclamations against the idea of reparations, but it really seems like in this case, the generational wealth that was taken, robbed when the businesses were burnt and people lost their homes and never got them back. Is that at play here? Do you think there might actually be some reparations that will come out of this?
I think that regardless of what happens in the courts of Oklahoma, the leaders of that community will continue to fight as long as they have breath. You've had philanthropists and people in the private sector donate hundreds of thousands, even millions, to the community, to these survivors. But will it really, there's a difference between a gift and reparations. Anyone can give someone a gift, but reparations is something that is given by the perpetrator to the one that was harmed. And so it's really about justice, and attorneys for the survivors believe this would set a horrible precedent for other people who are harmed seeking justice if the courts did not allow this to go to trial.
Dion Osborne. He's a journalist writing for the Oklahoma Eagle. Dion, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's it for us today. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Hafsa Qureshi, Shirley Jihad, James Mastromarino, and Jill Ryan. Our editors are Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. technical direction from Caleb Green and Mike Moschetto. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This advertisement comes from our paid sponsor, Fundrise. High interest rates mean that real estate assets are available at a discount compared to previous valuations. The Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to expand its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. Add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio at fundrise.com/NPR. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund before investing. Read the prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This message comes from NPR sponsor Stearns & Foster. Every Stearns & Foster mattress is handcrafted for irresistible comfort, with indulgent memory foam and ultra-conforming IntelliCoils for your most comfortable sleep. Learn more at stearnsandfoster.com.
On NPR's Throughline,
we cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt, because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.